You're tuned to WFHB.
Volunteer powered,
listener supported.
Community radio for South Central Indiana.
Good afternoon. Reporting remotely for WFHB, this is Benedict Jones.
And I'm Sydney Foreman. This is the WFHB local news for Monday, August 24th, 2020.
You know, all those things are potentially at risk, if not outright lost in the process of becoming homeless.
Later in the program, Diane Walker hosts a panel discussion with several sources in her Limestone Post story titled, Some Renter Help Available as End of Eviction Moratorium Looms. The discussion includes Forrest Gilmore of the Shalom Community Center, Deborah Meyerson of South Central Indiana Housing Opportunities, and Jamie Sutton of Justice Unlocked.
But if there's violence, it's a great concern.
Also coming up in the next half hour, a few minutes with the mayor. A weekly segment where Bloomington Mayor John Hamilton answers questions posed from WFHB and its listeners. But first, your local headlines.
Up first, here are three local headlines you need to know today.
From WFHB, this is the local news brief for Wednesday, August 21st. I'm Aaron Comforti. 671 new cases of COVID-19 were reported in Indiana on Sunday, according to the Indiana State Department of Health, which also added almost 1,000 previously unreported cases to the state's tally for the past few weeks. Locally, Monroe County has been seeing about 20 cases a day for almost a week. Yesterday, Lawrence County reported 3 new cases, while Greene County reported 9. Indiana University's online COVID dashboard is still in the development stage. We'll report on the university's COVID statistics as soon as they are made public. A demonstration in defense of law enforcement and in opposition for calls to defund the police called the Red, White, and All Caps Blue Rally turned violent as demonstrators and counter-demonstrators exchanged strikes and shoves around Bloomington's downtown courthouse square. Video from the event shows multiple scuffles. The rally's Facebook page described the event this way. A peaceful rally to support law enforcement, we cannot remain silent. Vox Booker, a member of the Monroe County Human Rights Commission, wrote a Facebook post where he connected the demonstration to historical white supremacist movements in the United States. He wrote, "These events, like the Klan rallies of old, are meant to instill fear and stoke violence, complete with white men on horseback. This isn't new. The Klan has merely been emboldened to remove their hoods." The Owlery, the most prominent vegetarian restaurant in Bloomington, is reopening under new ownership, the former owners announced on Facebook. The former owners wrote that they did not have the financial resources to open up safely. And as Indiana University begins in-person and virtual classes today, its primary video conferencing software, Zoom, is apparently experiencing worldwide technical difficulties with their web portal. That's all for your local news from WFHB.
Monroe County Health Administrator Penny Caudell said the 7-day average positivity rate is at 2.7% during the August 21st COVID-19 press conference. She said masks and social distancing are going to be normal functioning for a while.
I have to specify that we're going to need face covering wearing and social physical distancing until we have a vaccine and can really reduce and I want to say eliminate. I don't know that we'll ever eliminate it, but definitely reduce the community spread that is occurring in our community. So what that looks like, whether or not it's in a mandate for masks or whether it goes back to a recommendation at some point, people should understand that the need for those two things are going to continue along with the other prevention measures like cleaning and hand washing, staying home when you're ill. And I would say in terms of testing, remember that if you are a close contact or you're symptomatic or you are concerned about some place that you were at that you might be positive, you may have come in contact with someone who's positive, and you test, then you should quarantine until you get those test results back. And if they're positive, then you would maintain that isolation.
Caudell said close contacts also need to quarantine for 14 days since exposure. County Commissioner Julie Thomas said the November 3rd election will run as usual. She said only excusable absences can vote by mail.
Please note that you can check your registration at indianavoters.com, indianavoters, plural, .com. And please note, to vote absentee by mail, you can get a form at monroecountyvoters.us. But note that being afraid of catching COVID or contracting COVID is not a sufficient reason. So there are reasons listed on that form. Please review it. When you sign it, you are signing an affidavit.
Monroe County Emergency Director Allison Moore said face coverings will be available at all voting sites. Indiana University Assistant Vice President of Strategic Partnerships Kirk White said students in violation of the responsibility statement will face summary suspensions.
In addition, that can also mean suspensions or cancellation of scholarship and financial aid money. Those often require you to be in good standing with the university. Many of them are awarded by the university, and we're not going to be shy about canceling those scholarships if you're not in good standing with us. And the way that works is in the case of these party violations, which are just extreme cases of disrespect for what we're trying to do in the public health arena here. In those cases, either Bloomington Police Department or IUPD will investigate. We'll take the names of at least those who are organizing the party and perhaps others and report those to the Dean of Students' Office, who will quickly investigate and provide the sanctions.
White said mitigation testing will begin on Wednesday to monitor the spread of COVID-19 among students. He said IU would perform 8,000 tests per week. President of Indiana University Health Bloomington Hospital, Brian Shockney, said a slight decline has occurred in inpatients.
We have seen a slight decline in our number of inpatients in the South Central region by a few each day and the positive cases that are in our inpatient facilities. However, these cases continue to be of a complex and serious nature. And I want to state that these cases are more complex than we've seen in the past. They align with what we know about the age groups and types of patients that are highest risk. And they've resulted in a few deaths in the last week because of the sickness and the complexity of our patients that are getting COVID-19 in our community. So while the positivity rate remains low, which is a fantastic thing, since I reported last week, we've added 45 additional positive community members, with three of those community members succumbing to this virus.
Shockney said plasma transfusions are being used to care for COVID-19 patients. He said the IU Health has transfused their 200th patient with plasma.
This treatment, which is considered an investigational new drug by the United States Food and Drug Administration, involves collecting antibody-rich plasma from patients who have recovered from COVID-19. And then we transfuse that plasma to patients who are currently hospitalized due to their severe COVID-19 symptoms. The early data we're seeing suggests that the use of this is reducing mortality in our patients diagnosed with COVID-19, but we're still studying those results in this treatment.
Shockney encouraged COVID-19 recoveries to visit the COVID-19 recovery plasma donor page at iuhealth.org to make a donation.
Diane Walker continues her series on rental assistance after the statewide eviction moratorium and utility disconnection ban ended on August 14th. Today, she talks to Forrest Gilmore of the Shalom Community Center, Deborah Meyerson of South Central Indiana Housing Opportunities, and Jamie Sutton of Justice Unlocked. Here now is part four in the ongoing series with Diane Walker of the Limestone Post.
I'm Diane Walker. I'm the managing attorney of a local legal aid called District 10 Pro Bono Project, which collaborates on a Monroe County project called Housing and Eviction Prevention Program, or HEP, along with Community Justice Mediation, Justice Unlocked, and South Central Indiana Housing Opportunities. We're here today to talk about the end of the eviction moratorium, which is today, August 14th, and it was originally put in place by Indiana Governor Eric Holcomb on March 19th in an effort to keep renters in their homes during the COVID-19 crisis. With me today, I have Forrest Gilmore, Executive Director of Shalom Community Center. Welcome, Forrest.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
Deborah Meyerson, Executive Director of South Central Indiana Housing Opportunities. Thanks for being here today, Deb.
Thanks, Diane.
And Jamie Sutton, Executive Director of Justice Unlocked, a local nonprofit legal aid and a lawyer with Justice Unlocked. Welcome, Jamie.
Thanks. Good to see you again, Diane.
I should also mention that this conversation today is a follow-up to an article in Limestone Post, which is a local online magazine. And the article is called Some Renter Help Available as End of Eviction Moratorium Looms. It was originally published in Limestone Post on August 6th, 2020. According to the U.S. Census Bureau, in Indiana, about 288,000 households couldn't pay rent in July 2020, and about 458,000 households in Indiana didn't expect to be able to pay rent for this month. And that's out of about 1.3 million households which pay rent, or 18% of all the homes in Indiana. Jamie, does that mean that if people can't pay rent, that they can be evicted?
It absolutely does, Diane. Neither the Indiana executive orders through the governor or the Federal CARES Act program included any kind of rent forgiveness, rent freeze, or rent protection. So while there are programs out there which can assist with money to pay towards rent, even though the landlord could not file evictions up until this point, if you were behind on rent, you still owe that and you still can be evicted if you can't pay it.
Are there any defenses to eviction if you can't pay rent in Indiana?
Not many, really practically none. Obviously, there's always technical procedural defenses, like if you weren't properly served or if you have a bankruptcy pending that's put a freeze on you being evicted. But other than some very limited, very technical procedural things, generally speaking, if your landlord has filed properly, they've crossed their T's and dotted their I's, and you're behind on rent, then you will be evicted without much in way of a defense.
Now, you did mention that there's some rental assistance available to help pay rent in Indiana, and Indiana has set aside about $40 million from the Federal CARES Act funding and an additional $31.5 million in Special Emergency Solutions grant funding for lower-income households. And renters can apply for this assistance through the website IndianaHousingNow.org. Deborah, I just mentioned that there would be $40 million available with an additional $31.5 million for a total of about $71.5 million. Does your research show that that will be enough money to assist everybody?
That's an updated number. The last I'd seen before the most recent addition was put in was anticipated that of about 258,000 renters that were anticipated at risk, the earlier subsidy or rental assistance was only going to be able to cover about 58,000 of them. Mm-hmm. So there's certainly more that will be able to covered by the newest influx of rental assistance, but I suspect it's still not going to cover the entirety of the need that's out there.
You said 258,000 households, maybe 58,000 would be able to get help. There was an additional 15 million. So that's a little bit more, but that's still probably over 100,000, 150,000 households that won't be able to pay rent.
It's a pretty big crisis, right? We haven't seen something like this in our lifetimes. I mean, I know that people who are working in this field are doing everything they can to look at that. I mean, the Hoosier Housing Needs Coalition just yesterday, I believe, issued a press release calling for a housing stability dashboard that will help at least anticipate what progress is being made. And it's something that still needs to be confirmed and put together, but it's at least a measurement tool to say, how well are we doing with the available resources? Where does the need still exist? Because I feel like that's something that still needs to happen. So I applaud the Hoosier Housing Needs Coalition for calling for this dashboard.
What would the dashboard do?
It would help to track evictions and rental assistance data, because the state of Indiana as a state doesn't really track evictions statewide very well. Right. So it's really up to individual local governments. And of course, that can vary widely by county. And so this kind of a dashboard would, again, provide a more uniform way of measuring, again, how available sources of rental assistance are serving the need and what gaps may still exist.
Is there a hope that that could be used to be able to get more rental assistance?
I think that remains to be seen. Certainly measuring something means it's easier to address the need. Mm-hmm. Because if you don't have the measurement, you don't know the depth of the problem.
Right.
And so that's an important first step. but it's, again, still a pretty massive problem that we're anticipating and remains to be seen what exactly will be the outcome.
And Deborah, can you talk about what is at risk for a person or a family? And we're talking about families here too. About 55% of the people who said they couldn't pay rent in August had children under the age of 18. So can you talk about what people who lose their shelter through either eviction or even leaving voluntarily because they can't pay their rent, what kind of obstacles might they face?
Well, it's just a huge ripple effect. One of the modes of addressing housing needs that's often advocated for is housing first, because the ability to hold a job, to do well in school for students, for kids, all really is based on, can be traced to having stable housing. And so there's so many other things that get undermined when housing needs are not successfully addressed and when housing stability is at risk.
You mentioned that it could be particularly hard on kids. What in particular may apply that makes it harder for families with children?
If it's a family getting evicted, shelters that take families can be limited. Again, that varies widely by county. So you may have people living in cars, doubling up, overcrowded in homes. Again, when you're talking about, it's already difficult and challenging amid the pandemic of kids having stability in school because whether they're going face-to-face or doing virtually, how do you possibly manage that if you're also dealing housing stability? So the ability that's already challenging right now for so many families with figuring out how to handle school needs amidst pandemic concerns, that just gets magnified exponentially if you've got housing instability on top of that.
And you mentioned when I interviewed you for the magazine that schools provide a lot more than education. For example, they also provide food and technology and oversight, social workers, so that they're able to watch over kids and make sure that they're being correctly cared for. Have I missed anything there?
No, that's definitely an important point, that there are so many services that schools have traditionally provided. And there's a bunch of questions that this moment in time raises, if that's really appropriate for us to rely on schools for these multiple services. But it is what it is right now. And it's certainly true that, again, food security is affected if there's housing instability, if kids are relying on food access through school, as well as, again, an array of other potential social services or other needs that may be addressed, that if a family is experiencing housing stability in more typical times, school may provide, fill in some of those gaps. In the current moment, that is less of an option, or it's harder to provide just because so many things are changing with K-12 education in terms of how that's being delivered and the traditional services that may accompany that.
This is also affecting landlords too. Is that the case?
Well, landlords, this is a source of income for them, and it's not just income in terms of profit. It's how they maintain the properties. We operate a service called Housing for Hoosiers. There's a help desk that we operate, and so I get calls and emails daily with people asking about their rights and responsibilities as tenants and landlords. Mm-hmm. And so I certainly hear from landlords who are concerned that how are they going to pay for maintenance that's needed. I hear the other side from tenants saying, my air conditioning is not working. And they said they repair it, but they haven't shown up. And so you can see the tension on both sides of landlords saying, well, how am I going to pay my property taxes, cover my expenses on the property, maintain it if I don't have any rent income to pay for it? And of course, tenants who are dealing with what are declining or substandard properties if it's not being properly maintained. And so the lack of paying rent is exacerbating all that.
Right. And a lot of bigger landlords may be all right, but there are a number of mom and pop landlords in Indiana, right?
Sure. And so that's a variety of impacts, and whether it's large multifamily owners or smaller owners, you know, just own one or two properties, it certainly is across the spectrum that depending, you know, that impact may vary depending on, again, how much the property owner can absorb in terms of loss of revenue or loss of income. Certainly the rent relief being provided by the state of Indiana is an important first step even if it still needs to figure out how to fill the gap to meet the full need.
Right. Well, mom and pop landlords are also mom and pop businesses. So for every dollar that that they are not putting out in the out into the economy, then that's money that the economy loses as a whole. Would you agree?
It's an incredible economic impact, again, on all sorts of levels. We certainly see small businesses around the state, landlords among them, that are experiencing hardships because of the economic contractions that are happening as a result of the pandemic. And so housing is impacted by that as well.
Do you think it's fair to say that a lot of tenants switching back to the people who might be losing their homes, back to their point of view, is it fair to say that a lot of people might just be becoming homeless on the streets, nowhere to go?
I'm going to toss that one to Forrest. He's kind of got a good upfront perspective on that. I would appreciate hearing his thoughts on that.
Forrest, what do you think?
We haven't noticed yet a significant uptick in homelessness related to this, but the moratorium is still coming. So, you know, that's is ending now. So we expect to start to see the impact of it. Homelessness, particularly in recessions, has often a delay. And so we may not see it immediately. We may see it now. We may see it in a few months. We may see it. Sometimes that delay can be a year in terms of the impact. So we're going to watch, and this is one of the worst recessions, maybe the worst recession in our lifetimes. And we're going to have to watch it and see how it impacts people over time, not just in this immediate crisis moment.
How is it that being homeless or having housing instability affects people? Forrest?
I think anybody can put themselves in those shoes for just a minute to just think about that's, you know, I think that's one of our great terrors. I think all of us on some level have this fear of what would we do if we suddenly lost our resources, we lost our home, we lost our situation. And we can all, I think, recognize that, and it's cascading. Homelessness means we lose all the things that we have in our home that make it a home, beds, couches, silverware, pots and pans, all those kind of basics, the memorabilia that we, you know, connect us to family and history. Pets is a big issue. All those things are potentially at risk, if not outright lost in the process of becoming homeless. But then there's just the simple act of being homeless and that experience, living out of your car, living out of your shelter, out of a shelter, sometimes living in the woods or, you know, in other places like that, not meant for people to be living. And just then trying to get back on your feet with that scenario going on is incredibly difficult.
Now it's time for a few minutes with the mayor. In today's segment, Mayor John Hamilton answers questions on the pro-police protests that turned violent and reports of parties at Indiana University without masks or social distancing. Here now is that latest episode of A Few Minutes with the Mayor. Community members posted questions on our social media via Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter, posing questions to Bloomington Mayor John Hamilton about current issues. Today, on A Few Minutes with the Mayor, John Hamilton answers these questions. So the first question I have today is, how does or did the city react to multiple reports of large Indiana University student gatherings without masks or social distancing?
We were very concerned, and we remain concerned about what can be super spreader events, large parties. So I did, as mayor, under state statutes, use the authority that I have to declare a smaller limit on social private gatherings. We took it from 50 down to 15, from 50 down to 15. For the foreseeable future, just to try to avoid exactly those challenges of super spreader events. Not only can the virus get spread very quickly at those events, but can also overwhelm the contact tracing resources to find out who was there and reach out to them and find the people who connected with them. So
We put that into effect on Friday, August 21st at noon, and have been monitoring, working very closely with the IU police since then. My fingers are crossed. I think it's still 50-50 how it's all going to shake out. We've seen bad things happen in other communities, but we hope we'll be able to get through here and avoid the big super spreader events.
Mm-hmm. Does Indiana University plan on doing anything about these parties?
Well, besides just putting that rule in place, we've been communicating it very aggressively to our community, in particular the Indiana University community, but everybody, to remind people of that. We had actually electronic signboards out on the streets. We've had emails and texts going to students and IUPD, the police department from Indiana University, and the Bloomington Police Department are working very closely together as well with the Dean of Students of Indiana University to make sure we do all we can to help everybody comply with these restrictions. We also have had information shared from the Apartment Owners Association that have put information in the hands of all their tenants as they come to town.
And do you think just lowering this number is enough to truly inspire students not to hold these gatherings if they had already disregarded the 50 limit?
I don't know. I think hearing the news of schools that have had to go all online or send students home will help remind people the stakes. I hope people will think about their own family members or other people that they're putting at risk, but we'll find out. And, you know, even if 80% comply and 20% don't, that can still be a problem. So we need a lot of peer pressure and peer information to say, hey, you know, this is a special challenge and we have to come together and meet it responsibly and with common sense, and then we can move on, hopefully, in the future.
Well, the next question that I have is about this weekend. There was a report of a pro-police protest on the Bloomington courtyard and turned violent. Are the attackers known and will they be charged?
I'm just getting information on that. There were some fisticuffs, I guess, or scuffling and fighting at the courthouse downtown on Saturday night. I'm very pleased it wasn't worse. There were lots of firearms there, which is always of great concern. We have a long tradition of peaceful rallies in Bloomington, and we always do what we can to support the rights of people peacefully to protest. But if there's violence, it's of a great concern, and the police have been active and are involved and are investigating. I know there were some injuries. I don't believe any of them required hospitalization, which is good, and we'll try to figure out exactly what happened. I would just urge everyone to take a breath. We endorse and support peaceful protests, but it's really imperative that they remain peaceful. We will take all the steps that we can to assure that. Understandable, their emotions can run high with conflicting views, but it depends upon individuals controlling their own. And, you know, that's a really important thing, though, to keep protecting peaceful protests.
So it's unknown as of right now if they will be charged in any way?
I do not know if any charges are likely to come out of that. I'm trying to keep informed periodically from the police. Of course, charging decisions are made by the county prosecutor, not the city officials. But if there are any referrals made from law enforcement, and there may have been sheriff officers there as well as Bloomington Police Department, those referrals then get decided by the prosecutor on whether charges should be brought.
Well, the last question that I have today is, the temporary Kirkwood closure on the weekends for expanded seating and retail space is set to end in about a month here. Are there any current plans to expand the service longer into the year?
Well, the closures of Kirkwood to help some of those restaurants and proprietors have more space for outdoor dining and outdoor activities have been, I think, very well received. We've been lucky with a lot of good weather, too. And actually, they've expanded so that one block of Kirkwood is now being closed to automobile traffic every day. We're trying that block between Walnut and Washington to try that. And I think that's been popular. So I think we're going to see, as this pilot moves toward the end of September, I think we're going to see whether how the people feel about it in terms of using the space, and then how the proprietors and restaurants feel about it. We're pretty happy so far that it's helped make safer dining, and also I think the proprietors feel like it's helping them sell more food and have a better business, and the patrons seem to love it. So we'll keep watching. Maybe we'll just hope for really good weather through the fall. We'll see how it goes, but I'm really glad the pilot seems to be going well.
Do you have a question for Mayor John Hamilton? Comment that question on this coming week's post for a few minutes with the mayor to have your question answered. For WFHB, I'm Sydney Foreman.